First, I wanted to take a pause and do a little bit of a review, because we've covered a lot of Muktzah. And it's funny, I remember from way back when I was learning Muktzah on my own, that there was a chart in this book. People know this book? The four-part series, the four-volume book. It comes in a box set. It's called the 39 Malachos. A wonderful, wonderful resource, and it's in English. I mean, half of it is in English. The footnotes in the back are in Hebrew, which gives you greater elucidation. But the stuff in English, it's got pictures. It sort of goes through every malacha. What's the basis of it from the Mishkan? It goes through a lot, and it's very detailed. But in terms of the clarity of the detail, it's a wonderful book. It happens to not be so detailed in the Muktzah section, because it's really for the sake of the 39 Malachas. The Muktzah section is only like 20 pages. But in this book, I remembered learning way back when, they had this flow chart of all the different Muktzah categories. For whatever reason, this one doesn't have it. The one, and I'm like, I know I'm not crazy. So it happens that I went back to the one I have in my house, and it's in that one. So I don't know if this is the old one and this is the new one. This doesn't have the flowchart anymore. But it is actually, I happen to not like everything about the flowchart, but it's a wonderful illustration of the different categories and how they sort of orient with each other. We'll get to it when we finish it, I think, because I might want to make my own, because that one's not perfect. But it's good to sort of pause at this point and go over the categories that we've done so far, because this is called the 39 Malachas by Rabbi David Ribiat. Maybe you know him. Ribiat, yeah. I think so, yeah. I don't know if you made it while he was here, but I believe maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he's related something. I'm pretty sure that's the same guy. Either way, what? They're all related. Yeah. How many Ribiats do you know? It says the first line in the first dedication page, dedicated by Shlomo Einstein of Oak Park, Michigan. I don't know. Shlomo Einstein? I don't know. Either way, it's a wonderful, it's a really wonderful book for those who are really looking to understand the halachos of Shabbos in a more specific or more, what? This is number one. Muktzah. Yeah, the first volume goes through more of sort of the categories of Dinim Dirabanan before it gets into. Yeah, this is the first volume. I wonder if you have the chart or not. It would be on page 38. This book doesn't have a page 38. It goes from 37, and then 39. It has a blank page in the middle. I don't know. There are a bunch of spelling mistakes on the chart also, but whatever. Either way, so I wanted to pause here and go through a little bit of the categories. We've been at this for, I don't know, 10 months or so, maybe 9 months. And we've talked more generally about Muktzah. We've talked more specifically about the different categories. So I want to sort of take not a 5,000 foot view, but maybe like a 500 foot view. About Muktzah before we got into a new topic of Muktzah. We started by saying that Muktzah is generally understood to be things that a person does not expect to use on Shabbos. More extended from that, things that a person intends to not use on Shabbos. It's not that he doesn't intend, it's that he intends to not. And that's what it means. Muktzah is really a passive. It's a passive description. It is set aside. The question is, what does it mean to be set aside? And we've talked many times, especially when we go through the Gemara to understand the concept, we've talked many times about the breakdown, the distinction between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon. Muktzah could either mean it is by default Muktzah, that's what Rabbi Yehuda believes, or it's by default not Muktzah unless you actively pushed it away. And that's Rabbi Shimon, right? Innocent until proven Muktzah. Right? We've said it different ways. But we've talked about that's the concept of Muktzah. And how we understand, or what are the categories of things that are considered pushed aside? So that's what we've talked about in the past. So the first thing that we talked about most explicitly, category number one is a mukta machmas gufo. Some people would call it mukta mamish. That's how my Rebbe Rav Shechter would call it, mukta mamish. Right? That's sticks and stones. They break bones, they're also completely mukta. Right? They're completely mukta. They're inherently useless. Even Rabbi Shimon holds. Rabbi Shimon that holds innocence until proven mukta. Even he holds that mukta machmas gufo, something which is inherently useless, it's already mukta. It's already set aside. It's already off limits. Your intention is to not use it on Shabbos. That's category number one. That is the most stringent category that we have. The most stringent category because if you wanted to move it, you wouldn't be allowed to. Doesn't matter what, you could come up with the greatest excuse in the world, assuming that it has nothing to do with pikuach nefesh, you're not allowed to move it. It's also midrabanan, so there are times where you can move it. It shouldn't be so harsh. But relative to other muktas, it's the most stringent because it's completely useless. Even Rabbi Shimon says, no go. That's mukta machmas gufo. That's the most basic, default, mukta, six stones, completely useless. That doesn't mean, by the way, you can't preempt their status. You could even, according to Rabbi Shimon, you know, preemptively make a pile of stones. I'm going to use these stones on Shabbos. You'd be crazy if you're doing that. What are you going to use a pile of stones for? There are some people that have uses for them. Or sticks, you can make a pile of sticks, you can make a pile of bricks. Bricks is a little more complicated, but the point is that these things are generally assumed, even according to Rabbi Shimon, to be mukta. That was category number one. We spent a few weeks on that. Category number two was where most svarim, most books I found focused on, and that is what we're going to call kli shemalach l'iser. If you look at this book, and I had for many years used the terminology of this book, and it really threw me off because many other svarim don't use the same terminology. This book uses the phrase melachto l'iser, or it'll use the phrase mukta machmas iser, which is not a universal phrase. I don't know if they came up with it themselves, or they got it from the Mishnah Berurah or something like that, but they use the second category of mukta. They call it mukta machmas iser. That it's mukta because of a prohibition. And I've used that phrase with other people, and they don't understand what I'm talking about. Because it's not... What they mean is kli shemalach l'iser. Kli shemalach l'iser, as we've seen, and that was probably our biggest segment because there's so much to talk about in terms of how do you define something. It happens to be so much to talk about also because it's the most practical aspects of mukta, things that are sort of in between. They're utensils, but you shouldn't really use them. Things like hammers, things like, right, our two polar opposite examples of kli shemalach l'iser, kli shemalach l'heser, was a hammer versus a napkin holder, right? Those are both kelim, they're both utensils, there's a utility to them, there's a function to them, but one of them is, the function is primarily prohibited, when one of them, the function is primarily permitted. So we talked about the Gemara and Shabbos, Daf Kuf Chav Gimel, which goes through at great length the definitions of these, and if you remember, the different stages of the kelim that ultimately was Nehemiah ultimately decreed and then undecreed and made it usable. Long story short, this category of mukta is very different than the first category. The first category of mukta was mukta machmas gufo, mukta mamish. They're absolutely useless. This is not that category. This is kli shemalach l'iser. This category is things that could be useful but are generally prohibited, generally off limits. But we talked about how it might not be a category of mukta at all, right? Because, and I think the Gra made the point, if I remember correctly, the Gra made the point that if it were considered mukta, so it would not have any exceptions. The first category we talked about was mukta machmas gufo. There are no exceptions to that category. I mean, there are exceptions to what you can do with those things, but there are no exceptions. That category is mukta, mukta, mukta. You can't do anything with it, even according to Rabbi Shimon. You can't do anything with it. On the other hand, kli shemalach l'iser, what they're calling mukta machmas iser, they have another subcategory within this category, which I'm not sure it would be called iser, but we'll get to that a different time. Actually, I might get to it a little bit today, but I'm running circles in my mind. But mukta machmas isra according to them, klisha malachta isra according to us, is a separate kind of category. It has to do with a separate gezerah, a separate decree that Ezra Nehemiah created, which was in order to ensure that people, you know, kept Shabbos properly. And because it's a separate category, it's governed by different rules. And whereas mukta machmas gufo, mukta mamash, sticks and stones, even if you needed it, even if you could use it, even if you were going to use it for a permitted purpose, sorry, you can't use it. But klisha malachta isra, you need to use your hammer to open up a walnut, you can do that. That's called tzorech gufo. Tzorech gufo, if you want to use it for the thing itself, the hammer itself is useful to you in a permitted way, obviously, then you can do that. That was one subcategory of exceptions for klisha malachta isra. Yeah.
Where
Ezra Nehemiah on Daf Kuf Chav Gimel said, all kalim are usher. Then slowly but surely they peeled that back and said, okay, not all kalim, only klisha malachta isra, and only when there's no use to them. So that's a separate category. Everything Ezra Nehemiah did was only within klisha malachta isra. Mukta machmas gufo, Chazal said that one. Right, that was, you know, this is Chazal too, but the point is that that's across the board, according to Rabbi Yehuda, according to Rabbi Shimon, everybody agrees with that. There's a discussion whether or not there's even a distinction between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon. If you remember, we talked about this for a couple of weeks. Whether there's even a discussion, whether there's a distinction between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon in terms of this second category. Klisha Malachta Isra, it's its own independent category. It has nothing to do with Muksa. It could be a different idea altogether. It happens to be that both Muksa and Klisha Malachta Isra are about whether you can touch them, whether you can move them, so you kind of just throw them together. This book calls it a second category of Muksa. And that's how we generally look at it. I don't want to like misrepresent it, but halachically they could be different things, right? For the halachic mind, you categorize them separately. There's Muksa, which is sticks and stones, and then there's Klisha Malachta Isra, which are utensils that could be useless, could be useful. So if it's a klisha malachta isra, going back to what we said before, there are two main exceptions. Tzorech gufo, something that you need it, the hammer, to open the walnut. That's one exception. You're allowed to use the hammer. It's not bidyeved. You can use it. L'chatchila, you can use it. We talked about some reasons maybe you shouldn't use it if there's something else available. Some would say, the Mishnah Berurah would say, you shouldn't use it if you could use something else. If you've got, a nutcracker, which is designated for that, so maybe that would be better. So that's category number one of the exceptions. It's tzorech gufo. If you need the thing itself, you could use the thing itself. The other exception was tzorech makomo. If you don't need the hammer, who needs the hammer? But the problem is the hammer is on my chair. I need to sit in that chair. No one wants to sit on a hammer. So you can move the hammer for that also. L'chatchila, it's not a question. You're allowed to move that hammer. You don't have to do it with your elbow. You don't have to kick it off with your foot. You can pick up the hammer and move it somewhere. That's klisha malachta isra. That's category number two. There's also klisha malachta hetzer. That's a napkin holder. That's not a category of muksa because it's always allowed, right? I think we talked about this a little bit also. If it's absolutely useless, you can't just play around with a klisha malachta hetzer. I don't think it's possible like that. But the point is that some would say that you need to have some kind of use in order to even touch a klisha malachta hetzer. Then, possibly as a subcategory to that, possibly as its own category, which we talked about is depending on whether you're going to classify it as category number one, Muksa Mamish, or category number two, Klisha Malachta Isra. If you remember, we talked about whether it's a subcategory of Klisha Malachta Isra, or it could be anything. We had Muksa Machmas Chiseron Kis. That's the third category of Muksa, or the subcategory of Klisha Malachta Isra. Let's, for simplicity's sake, call it a third category. We've got Muksa Mamish, we've got Muksa Machmas Isser, or what we'll call Klisha Malachta Isser. Number one, Muksa Mamish. Number two, Klisha Malachta Isser. Number three, Muksa Machmas Chiseron Kis. Muksa Machmas Chiseron Kis, as we talked about, is a Muksa which is not just a utensil, but also a utensil which is particularly expensive, particularly valuable. Those are two separate things, expensive versus valuable. It could be precious. It could be a family heirloom. It could be something which you don't want anybody touching, right? That was the big saw blade of the plow, right, that Rashi talked about. Or it could be a bris milah knife, something which is, you know, not very big, maybe not even very expensive, but something you don't want anybody to touch. That's Kli Shem Lach Del Isser. And what we said there was, for all practical purposes, it's a Kli Shem Lach Del Isser. It's a utensil which is usually designated for a prohibited purpose, like bris meal, but it doesn't have to be. That was the machlokas, whether it has to be Kli Shem Lach Del Isser or anything else. Right? If you remember, we talked about, let's say, spoons that you're selling in a store. So that could be Mukta Machmas Kitaron Kis, but it's still a spoon, a spoon, a spoon, a spoon. So there's a machlokas poskim, right? We said, I think it was the Baal HaTanya in Shulchan Aruch Harav says, it cannot become ever in the history, it's impossible for a spoon to be Mukta Machmas Kitaron Kis. Because you can only be Mukta Machmas Kitaron Kis once it's a Kli Shem Lach Del Isser. A spoon is not categorically Kli Shem Lach Del Isser. Okay, we talked about that then. You can, re-listen to those classes. But this third category, Mukta Machmas Kitaron Kis, basically transforms. It transforms a Kli Shem Lach Del Isser into a Mukta Machmas Gufo. In terms of practical purposes. I mean, it doesn't make it into category number one, but it is its own category that we treat like category number one. So for instance, you have a bris milah knife. A bris milah knife is already a Kli Shem Lach Del Isser. It's already a utensil which is designated for a prohibited purpose. You can do a bris milah on Shabbos. That's not what I mean. The act itself is a prohibition. The act itself is a prohibition. We happen to be allowed to if that bris is on the day it's supposed to be, right? If it's a C-section or if it's not an eighth day bris, you're not allowed to use it, right? You're not allowed to do bris milah, right? Because you are overriding the isser in order to do the mitzvah when you're allowed to, right? The point is that it's Kli Shem Lach Del Isser because you are doing an isser. So that bris milah knife is already Kli Shem Lach Del Isser. If we categorize the thing, the item, as a Kli Shem Lach Del Isser, as we've said before, you could use it for something else. This might sound grotesque, but if we're talking about bris milah knife, you could theoretically use it to cut something else. You know, maybe you're not going to, but I'm saying you could theoretically use it. Once it becomes, and that would make it Kli Shem Lach Del Isser, that you're allowed to use the Tzorach Gufo, Tzorach Mekomo. If your bris milah knife was not Mukta Machmas Kitaron Kis, but was only Kli Shem Lach Del Isser, and it was on your chair, you could pick it up and move it off your chair. But now that we have established that it's a Kli, not just a Kli Shem Lach Del Isser, but also Mukta Machmas Kitaron Kis, as I said before, it creates the status of category number one. You can't touch it at all. It's like sticks and stones. Right? So it's a subcategory of Kli Shem Lach Del Isser, but it becomes more stringent like Mukta Machmas Gufo, or Mukta Mamish, we will call it Mukta Mamish. Right? So that's category number three, that's Mukta Machmas Kitaron Kis. Lastly, we talked about the concept of Mukta Machmas Mius, the concept of something which is Mukta because it's disgusting. Right? This was, at least according to the Mishnah, according to Rabbi Yehuda, presumably, it was the category of the lamp that was used and disgusting, all oily or all waxy. According to Rabbi Yehuda, it's disgusting and therefore you can't touch it. Just the disgustingness of it means you can't touch it. Now, Rabbi Shimon responds to that, what do you mean I can't touch it? It's still useful. Even if something is disgusting, I can still use it. It doesn't matter if it's disgusting. We don't create muktzah because something's disgusting, according to Rabbi Shimon. However, there are some things that are so disgusting that they revert back to category number one. They become sticks and stones, right? They become useless in terms of what you can use them with before, right? A dirty diaper, you're not going to use a dirty diaper for anything. So that makes it into Muktamachmas Gufo. It's completely useless. And there's a worthwhile discussion about how to treat dirty diapers. Maybe when we're done with all these categories, we can just do a whole quiz about what do you think about this? What about that? What about this? Right? How do you deal with a dirty diaper? Now, we talked last week about this case of the feces in the courtyard. Right? Is the courtyard useful? Is it not useful? And through that, we came to the concept of graf shel rei, which is basically, even if we're going to eliminate most of mukta machmas mius, because everything's still useful, right? Even a dirty lamp is still useful. That which is left over in the category, things that are disgusting and not useless and not useful, even those would most likely be movable because they're disgusting. Right? There's a very small sliver of things which are completely disgusting, not useless, but also not so disgusting that you can't move them because they're so disgusting. Right? There's a separate allowance of moving disgusting things because they're affecting your own Shabbos.
What's that called?
What, the allowance to move it?
Yes.
That's graf shel ri'i. It's a concept called graf shel ri'i, which means literally a pan of excrement. That's what we talked about last week. So if something, if you have excrement in your house, you can move it because that's affecting your Shabbos experience.
But isn't that not sanitary?
Correct.
And a dirty diaper is not sanitary either.
Presumably, yeah.
You have to move
Yeah,
it.
Yeah, you'd be allowed to move it if it's in your way.
Yeah.
For sure. Some dirty diapers are more disgusting than others.
Sure.
So it depends on the situation. But it could depend on the situation. And that, by the way, is more subjective. That's a little more subjective as opposed to other categories of mukta that we've talked about, which are less subjective and more, you know, categorical. If something, you know, even if Mark Zuckerberg's iPhone was on the floor, he would still not be allowed to touch it. Even though he doesn't care, it's just an iPhone. Like, to me, that's like a penny, you know? Doesn't matter. It is a valuable item regardless of what he thinks about it. Halavai, he should think those questions. Yeah. But the point is that this is more subjective. Some things can be disgusting to one person, not disgusting to another person. Last week we also talked about, within this conversation, we talked about garbage cans. And putting out the garbage can, taking back the garbage can, is it disgusting? Is it prepared? Right? Is it already mukhan? Have you already prepared from before Shabbos? I'm going to move my garbage can and therefore it's okay. So there you have our four categories thus far. Mukta mamish, klisha ma'akta le'isr, mukta machmas chiseronkis, and now mukta machmas mius. We said the first, the fourth category we just did basically doesn't exist in a practical sense. It's either so disgusting you can move it, or it's not so disgusting and therefore there's utility to it. Right? One of the two. So it almost doesn't exist. But, in practical sense. But, and then we said number three, mukta machmas chiseronkis, reverts back to treating it like a mukta machmas gufo. The first category. So really, there are only two categories of mukta. But each one of these is sort of like a different way of getting to, it's like a different, you know, it's a different route to get to the same destination. Right, so that's why they're separate categories, but they're technically, they all mean the same thing ultimately. It's just how did you get there, and what kinds of items, which maybe you would have thought aren't included, are actually included. That brings us to tonight's new topic. This topic, this is somewhat of a punny introduction, but tonight's topic is somewhat amorphous. It's hard to pin down. It's not explicitly spoken in as a different category. But this is another one of those examples. Chalk this up to, you know, similar to 3, 4, and 5, now 5, right? It's similar to mukta machmas chiseronkis and mukta machmas mius, where we're taking a different route to the same destination. This is a concept called nolad. Nolad literally means born, something which was born into existence on Shabbos. Let's rewind to the beginning of our review tonight and to the beginning of this concept generally. The word mukta means it's pushed aside. You could also look at that as being the opposite of mukhan. Mukhan means prepared. Mukta means pushed aside. Mukhan, again, means something you have in your mind, I'm going to use it, whether passively that's in your mind or practically or consciously in your mind. That could even be sticks and stones. If you prepare them, I'm going to use them. But generally, we assume the status of things. Right? Your silverware, you don't have to consciously say, I'm going to use my silverware on this Shabbos. Right? Because that's assumed. That's Rabbi Shimon, right? So that's mukhan. Things that are prepared in your mind, you're expecting to use them. That's mukhan. Mukta is the opposite of that. It's those things which you have either explicitly said, I'm not using that, or implicitly it's understood, I'm not going to use that. That's the bris milah knife. Everyone, you know you're not going to use that on Shabbos. That's the expensive computer. You know you're not going to use that, besides the fact that it's us or otherwise. Right? You know you're not going to use those things. What? Right? Your expensive kitchen items, whatever it might be. You're not going to use those things. Those are Those are the opposite of muchan. They're you know, muchan to not use, right? They're prepared like you're not going to use them. Okay? That's what we call muktzah. Anything which is not prepared, right? They're mutually exclusive, right? One means the other, right? If they're not muchan, that means they're muktzah. If they're not muktzah, that means they're muchan, right? There's no gray zone. There's no neutral category here. Nolad, by its very essence, by its very definition, is something that cannot be prepared for. I'll put an asterisk on that, and we'll see a footnote for that later, right? Muchan, nolad means it doesn't exist yet. How can I prepare for something that doesn't exist? If I can't prepare for something that doesn't exist, so then it is by nature muktzah. It can't be not muktzah, because I can't prepare it. The only thing that's not muktzah, again, they're mutually exclusive. The only thing that's not muktzah is something that I can prepare, whether it's passive or conscious. If I can't prepare it, so then it won't be considered. It won't be considered muchan. It has to be considered muktzah, put aside. What's some examples of that? Give me an example of something which is born, which is nolad. Yeah.
Would it be
pipe? Oh, that's a wonderful example. Tell me why it would be, and then tell me why it wouldn't be.
It would be because it doesn't exist in that form.
Good. But
it would be because it's already
one. Ah, okay. We're going to have to talk about that. That's one of the most practical examples of this category. Is ice considered nolad? Is ice considered nolad? It, all of the elements of that ice existed before Shabbos. They were all there. They might not have been affected in the way that they were yet, but that doesn't mean that they weren't there. Can I look at the water in my pipes and say, I'm using that water no matter what form they're in? Can I say that? So that's going to be how we have to think about that. Let's say another example. Let's say more literally. Now, this only happens on Yom Tov because on Yom Tov, you can do things for Ochel Nefesh. What about an egg that was laid on Yom Tov? That's the beginning of Maseches Beis that we have in front of us. We'll see that in a second. I'll give you another fascinating example. What about a newspaper? Now, newspapers have other problems with them. They might come from outside of the tchum when they get to your house, when your doorstep on Shabbos morning. It could be that there's a restriction about reading worldly matters on Shabbos. Assuming those things are not relevant, okay? Assuming those things don't exist. What about nolad? Right? It could be a problem of nolad because before Shabbos, that newspaper didn't exist. Then they make it and it ends up at your doorstep. That thing could not have been prepared for. You cannot say, I'm going to read tomorrow morning's, front page headlines. Because they don't exist yet. Except they do exist, right? They exist. There's the ink over here, and then there's the paper or the tree over here, and then you've got the machinery that's going to put it all together. Everything exists, just doesn't exist in that form, so it's similar to the ice. Except the ice, you really know what you're getting. And here, you don't really know what you're getting. So it doesn't matter if you cannot expect the form, right? If you can't anticipate what the form is, does that make a difference? Right? So we'll have to get into some of these definitions of what is nolad, what isn't nolad. Another example. The Gemara has a whole discussion about this, about an amud long. Maybe next week we'll get it. Do we have class next week? I think it might be a board meeting. I don't remember. But is there a board meeting? There's no board meeting tonight?
Yes.
What's today? Oh, it's well, okay. Yeah. Board meetings are the second Wednesday of the month. Tonight is still May. So it's not the, it's in 2 weeks from now. So next week maybe we'll get into this Gemara. The Gemara in Daf Mem Vav or Mem Heyom Ed Beis in Erevin asks, what about rain? What about rain? Like it comes from the heavens, it comes from the sky, that stuff? Is that nolad or not? Let's say I collect rain in a receptacle on Shabbos. Can I drink it? Can I drink the rain that falls on Shabbos?
It's just water in a different form.
Ah, can I say, oh, I'm going to drink that tomorrow. Can I do that? Is that possible? Maybe you can, maybe you can't. But we'll have to talk about that tomorrow explicitly. Another example of that is snow, obviously. What if the rain comes down and freezes upon impact? Is that any different than the rain? It's changing form again. Right, when it rains, it always changes form. But the question is whether that changing of the form is different enough to say that it's considered nola. Correct. So there's a separate extension of the concept of nolad, which is called the Isser of Molid. That is something that Rashi made up, but could still be a real concept. I mean, the reason I say he made up is because you don't find that anywhere in Chazal. The concept of Molid, it's like the 40th Molacha. It's something that's not a thing, but it's talked about as a thing. Can you make ice on Shabbos? Can you defrost ice on Shabbos? Right. So all of those are discussions that maybe we'll get into. Can you create the Isser of Nolad? Yeah.
So I guess it's somewhat related. Nolad doesn't have to be something that you have a hand in.
No. I mean, Nolad is anything that came into existence on Shabbos. Now, what does it mean to come into existence? That's part of the question, right? Does changing the form say that it didn't exist before? Or is that just, it existed in a different form, and now it's just sort of morphed, right? Amorphous, as I said before. It doesn't exist in the same way that it existed before. But yeah, no, you don't have to have any process, right? The chicken laid the egg, and now you're wondering, can I use it? Right. It didn't exist. What?
What about clothing?
With his hand. Clothing?
But it still has a hand.
What does that have to do with Nolad?
You can't use it on Shabbos. Yeah, it has a hand. It's unusable with his hand.
Why is it unusable?
Huh?
Why is it unusable?
You
have
to
take off the clothing.
You
have to? You have to?
Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't mean it's unusable. You might not want to walk around with a tag on. It's not clear, by the way, you can't take tags off on Shabbos. That's a different question. But that wouldn't make it unusable to usable. There are instances where something becomes usable. Let's say a fruit ripens on Shabbos.
Ooh.
Right? Yesterday my banana was green, and now my banana is yellow. It was generally considered inedible, and now it's edible. So does that make a difference? So hopefully we'll get to those categories. So that's the concept of Nolad. And the discussion really comes up in two places, this Gemara at the beginning of Maseches Beitza, and the Gemara in Erevin about the rain in the clouds. So let's read from Maseches Beitza. You might hear the Maseches Beitza called by other names. Anyone know what other names Maseches Beitza is called? Nobody knows this? Be'ah. That's right. What does Be'ah mean?
Yeah.
Same as Beitza. That's in Aramaic. It could be a Beitza has another translation that might be inappropriate, but the truth is putting in Aramaic doesn't change the word at all, so I don't know. Some people will call it Maseches Yom Tov, because it's all about Yom Tov. That's really what Beitza is all about. And then my grandfather once called it Maseches Muktzah, because the beginning is all about Muktzah. Well, we're about to talk about it in a second. So those are four names for Maseches Beitza. If one were to look at Rabbeinu Chananel, one of the greatest proofs that the Rishonim didn't call it by any other name is this phrase in Rabbeinu Chananel. If you look at the left-hand side, you see a commentary by Rabbeinu Chananel. He was Sephardi. A lot of the Sephardic rabbis used poems in their introductions and conclusions. So he says here, Aschil Maseches Beitza ve'ezras gadol ha'itza. It's a rhyme. Right? It wouldn't make sense if he didn't call it that. Right? We are now starting Maseches Beitza with the great help of guidance. Eitza is like, counsel or something. Right? So he's rhyming the word Beitza with Eitza. You can't say the word Ea. It doesn't make any sense. So clearly Rabbeinu Chananel used it with the word Beitza. That's on the left-hand side of the paper I gave out. Rabbeinu Chananel. You see it? Aschil Maseches Beitza ve'ezras gadol ha'eitza. Yeah. That's not how you typically spell Eitza, but okay, fine. Yeah, I think he's also trying to parallel how you spell Beitza. What does Beitza have to do with? Beitza shenolda b'yom tov, exactly what we talked about before, an egg that was born on Yantif. Can you use it or not? What do we think before we jump in here? Yes or no?
No.
No. You think no? Any other opinions?
I think
yes. You think yes. Thank you, Hilby. Says the Mishnah. Beis HaShanel de B'yam Tov, Beis Shammai Omrim Tochal, Ubeis Hillel Omrim Lo Tochal. Beis Shammai is of the opinion that you can eat it. Beis Hillel is of the opinion that you can't eat it. If you look at Rashi, top right, look at Marvin Parishama. Hold on. So let's skip to the Gemara then. Asks the Gemara, b'may askinan, what are we talking about? Usually that's predicated with the word hacha b'may askinan, but I guess it's the beginning of the mission. What else could we be talking about? B'may askinan, with what are we dealing? Ilema, the word ilema is really a conjunction of two words, e, which means if, and lema, if and say, right? It's one word though in Gemara. Ilema, if you want to say, b'tarnegoles ha'omedes la'achila, if you're going to tell me that this is referring to a chicken or a hen, right? Hen's lay egg?
Hen's lay egg.
If you're going to tell me it's referring to a hen which has already been designated to be eaten, right? You want some fresh chicken the next day, right? So this hen, I'm going to be eating this hen on Yantif. And that's the hen that lays an egg.
So then the
egg is part of that which is already being eaten. So then my ta'amaihu de Beis Hillel. Why? What is the reason? My ta'amaihu. What is their reason? The who there is there, right? My ta'amaihu de Beis Hillel. What is the reason of Beis Hillel? Uchla de Ifras who. Uchla de Ifras means, if you look at Rashi, I don't want to keep it away here. If you look at the Gemara, Ha'omedes la'achila, says Rashi, She'ena mukta, right? Anything which is designated for eating is not mukta. Just naturally, I'm going to eat this chicken. Typically, animals are mukta, by the way. We've talked about that in the past also. Animals are mukta. There are ways you can take care of them without touching them directly, whatever. But this animal is not mukta because you're going to eat it. And therefore, even though it's alive right now, you can shecht on Yantif. On Yantif, not on Shabbos. And therefore, it's not mukta. And then it says Rashi, Uchla de Ifras, Ochel Shenifrad. You're basically just taking off a chicken wing. What's the difference between, you know, what my mother would call pulque and the egg that comes out of the chicken? They're both part of the chicken. Right? They're just parts of the chicken. So why can't you eat it on Yantif? Okay, there's got to be some words missing here. Hold on. Yeah. Okay. So back into the Gemara. Uchla de Ifras, so why would Beis Hillel say it's no good? Ella, rather, betarnegoles ha'omedes l'gadlo beitzim. We're not talking about a hen which is being eaten itself, but we're talking about a hen. Like nowadays, the hens are designated for laying eggs. I'm not going to eat this chicken, but I'm going to eat whatever comes out of it. In which case, the question is, can you already assume that which is inside of the animal is prepared for? But if that's the case, if it doesn't exist yet, if it doesn't exist, I cannot prepare it in my mind. How do I know that this hen is going to lay an egg? Maybe I'm pretty smart. I know my hens. I know, you know, their general timetables, but I still don't see an egg. So how can I prepare for that? So in which case, my time out of Beis Shammai. What's the reason for Beis Shammai? Why would Beis Shammai say you're allowed to eat that egg? You can't prepare it. Muktzahu, says the Gemara. Muktzahu, it is set aside. You can't possibly prepare it. Says the Gemara, wait a second. Why are we so quick to jump on Beis Shammai? Why are we so quick to... Maybe Beis Shammai holds like a very important person. Maybe he's of the opinion that what am I going to say?
Nothing.
Maybe he holds like Rabbi Shimon. If you look at my kushya, what's the question? Dilma Beshamai Leifluhu Muksa. Maybe he doesn't hold the Muksa. He doesn't think it exists. There's no such thing as Muksa. And as we know, that doesn't really mean there's no such thing as Muksa, but it means that you have the default setting is not Muksa. Right? That's Rabbi Shimon. The default setting is not Muksa. If you look at Rashi, back to Rashi, the next Rashi there, Leifluhu Muksa, the Dilma Kribi Shimon Sviruluhu. Maybe, perhaps, the Dilma, perhaps, like Rabbi Shimon, they hold. Rabbi Shimon is a group of people, right? The Amar Reperi Kira, Shabbos Memdal, which you saw a couple weeks ago. Mosar Hashemin Shebiner, Veshebikara, Aser, Dibri Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon Matzer, the leftover oil in the lamp. Rabbi Yehuda says you can't use it. Rabbi Shimon says you can. I don't care that you couldn't use it before. Right now you can use it, and you prepared it to be used. Yeah. Hillel and Shammai did. Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai might not have. Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel are the students of Hillel and Shammai. Hillel and Shammai generally got along together, but it's the students they always argue. Yeah. So now the Gemara says an unbelievable line, which will help us categorize this concept of Novi. Kasalka Daitin means we are under the presumption at this point that afilu man deshari v'mukta, even the one deshari who allows mukta, Rabbi Shimon, v'nolad asar, when it comes to nolad, it's forbidding. Yes, we agree that mukta is default okay. Everything's assumed to be usable until deemed unusable. That's Rabbi Shimon. But who are you kidding? You can't use that concept for something that doesn't exist yet. Yes, all your knives are assumed to be useful, and all your spoons, and your cups, and your plates, and your cutlery, whatever it is, we'll assume it's all mukhan. You're prepared for all of it. But if you don't know something exists, how can you prepare for it? Don't tell me that Rabbi Shimon holds you can prepare for something that doesn't exist yet. That's a step too far. That's way too far. You can't possibly prepare for that. And even Rabbi Shimon would say it's aser. Even Rabbi Shimon would say it's mukta. So we'll pause it there. We'll pause it there to look at Rashi and Tosfos, and that's where we're going to leave it for tonight. I don't know if we'll continue the Gemara or not. It is a fascinating discussion. It's actually a good review of a lot of the concepts we've been talking about. But let's look at Rashi. The next Rashi on the top right, really in the middle here. Kasaka Daitin. Lahachi Parchin and Mai Tanai de Beis Shammai. This is why we asked about Beis Shammai, right? We said, why are you asking about Beis Shammai? What's the question? Maybe he holds a Rabbi Shimon. So no, the reason we asked is because we're under the impression that maybe even someone who holds the Rebbe Shimon would hold that Nolad is still Aser. Because Saka Daitin da'afilu the Rebbe Shimon the Shari b'Mukta, even Rebbe Shimon who is of the opinion that Mukta is allowed, b'Nolad Aser, by Nolad it's still prohibited, the ilu b'Mukta svirlei. Because when it comes to mukta, generally, he's of the opinion severe lay, he believes, lo mekase inish mi da'ate midi dechazi lay. Anyone want to break that down for us? Lo mekase.
Is that mukta?
It's not pushed aside. Lo mekase inish mi da'ate. Inish is, like enosh is a person, right? A person does not push aside mi da'ate, from his mind. He doesn't push aside from his mind midi something, dechazi. Chazi here refers more to befitting or relevant. Dechazi lay that he could use. Something which is usable. Right? Something which is usable, a person is not going to say, I'm not going to use it. Why would I ever say that about my forks? Why would I ever say I'm not using my knives? Of course I'm going to use them. Default is that they're usable. So that's why Rabbi Shimon holds that everything is default, not mukta. because they're usable. Aval, no lie, something which is born on Shabbos or Yantif, lo have a yada. He didn't know about it. Didn't have a date alavi. He didn't even know about it so that he could think anything about it. His forks, if you ask him on Friday afternoon, you're going to use your forks? Yeah, of course I'm going to use my forks. What about that thing that doesn't exist yet? I don't know. I can't possibly prepare for it. Now, if I knew exactly what was coming, maybe it's different. If I knew exactly that there was an egg going to be born, maybe that's different. That's what Gemara is going to talk about a little bit. If you look at Tosfos also, on the other side of the page, this is Rashi's grandchildren. A similar thing. The low, this is in Kalsaka Dyson. It's a little further down. Tosfos, you see it? It's toward the bottom of the Gemara. Kalsaka Dyson, da'afilu ma'ad d'shari musa b'nola nastir. Says Tosfos, to low mikat, si inish mai d'chazilei. You didn't know about it yesterday, and therefore it's going to be a problem. All right, I don't want to get into this. Suffice it to say, Tosfos is going to rope in to this discussion two different Gemaras. One Gemara is going to be about a broken vessel, a vessel that at the onset of Shabbos was very usable, and now it's not usable. So can you use the broken shards of that vessel? And then he's also going to rope in the question about the clouds and the rain. So we're going to cut it off here, and we'll continue the discussion, hopefully with those Gemaras in mind, next week. The Gemara about the broken vessel, but most prominently the Gemara about the cloud and the rain. But here you have the fifth category of Muktzah. The fifth category of muktzah is that which did not exist at the onset of Shabbos. So again, we've got muktzah machmas gufo, sticks and stones, completely useless. Then we have klisha malachil iser, the utensils around your house, which are designated for prohibited purposes. You can only use those for those exceptions, if you need the thing, or if you need the space that the thing is on. Then we have number three, muktzah machmas chisaron kis, something which is muktzah because of how expensive it is, even though you could have used it because it was only a kli. You could use it for specific purposes. Now that it's super expensive, we're not going to let you use it. Then we talked last time, the fourth category, muktzah machmas minhag, was disgusting, which basically doesn't exist because it could still be useful, or it's so disgusting that I can move it. But then if you really toe the line there, there could be something that's so disgusting that I don't need to move around, like if it's in a different chaser, like we talked about last week. And now we have our fifth category of nolad, something which did not exist before Shabbos. Something which does not exist before Shabbos. We are discussing whether we'll sort of subsume that within category number one. Are we going to say that this is something which is completely useless because you couldn't have prepared for it? Or are we going to say that it's not on the list at all, that I could prepare for it, and therefore it's going to be usable? It depends on the situation, but as we go along, we'll try to define better what does it mean for something to come into existence on Shabbos, and how is it that Rabbi Shimon holds up or doesn't hold of this category, because as we saw in Muktzah Machmas Mios, he doesn't really hold of it, and we possibly Rabbi Shimon. So what does he think about Nolad? That's exactly the question that the Tosfos is going to ask in the next few lines. Okay, we'll pick it up there next week. Exciting new category.